for a while, it looked like they had his number. In fact, the Detroit Pistons invented a term for it, the Jordan Ruse, which was a defensive strategy employed by the Detroit Pistons against Michael Jordan in order to limit his effectiveness on offense. Devised by their head coach, Chuck Daly, in 1988, the Pistons' strategy was to play him tough, to physically challenge him in order to throw him off balance. The Pistons defeated the Bulls in the 1988 Eastern Conference semifinals and would go on to beat them the next two seasons in the Eastern Conference finals. But in 1991, Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls reinvented themselves. And with the help of their new coach, Phil Jackson, they implemented the triangle offense and not only swept the Pistons, but went on to win the championship. Jordan would dominate the NBA for the next decade. He demonstrated the power of reinventing oneself. After pondering for quite some time about how Michael Jordan did it, I figured it out. Mike made some minor adjustments to his game. I would eventually model the next phase of my life after Michael Jordan in an attempt to become one of the greats. Michael Jordan, he placed himself in a structured system. Eric Thomas, I went back to school and brought more structure to my game. Michael Jordan, he went from an individual to a teammate. Eric Thomas, I developed a nonprofit organization and hired students to go on the road with me to lighten my burden. Michael Jordan, he studied the game on a deeper level and began watching more film. Eric Thomas, I became a student of the game by mimicking people who were better at the technical aspect of the game, i.e. promotional materials, networking, and business cards.
Nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. It's not who you are that holds you back. It's who you think you're not. Eric Thomas.
Just as the triangle offense helped Michael Jordan dominate the game, I knew deep down inside that going back to college could help me take my speaking career to a whole nother level. And by going back to school, that would require me to make some serious professional sacrifices. I was all too familiar with the kind of commitment you had to make and the amount of time you had to devote to your studies in order to do well. My poor study habits were another concern. As long as I could remember, I was never a serious student. I just went to school, and I never had a real love for learning. My friend Lois, she had that love for academics. When we would go bowling on the weekends, she brought her textbooks. I'm talking about she brought her textbooks to a bowling alley. I remember thinking, who does that? Who brings their books to a bowling alley? And between frames, she would grab her highlighter and start taking some serious notes or reviewing her flashcards. It never dawned on me that that's what real students do. They study. Students don't do it just for a letter grade or a numerical value. No, they study because it's in them. Lois, she might have taken breaks during her four-year stay in college, but I promise you, I never saw her take one break. And although I had been out of school the last 3 years and had no proof of any academic progress, my work in the community and the church preceded me. So I wasn't surprised when my academic advisor reinstated me. She probably figured that I had matured during my extended vacation and that I would make better decisions the second time around. And you know what? She was 100% right. I managed to finish the school year with a 3.5 GPA. And I owe a lot of my success that school year to Lois. I knew for a fact that Lois, she had the secret to academic success. and all I had to do was sit at her feet and learn her system. Like Michael Jordan, I knew once I learned that new system, there was absolutely no stopping me. The following advice is a result of my conversation with Lois Clay and my personal observation of Michael Jordan. Number one, get support. One of the first mistakes I made as a freshman was I was playing individual ball. I knew I needed help, but I was so embarrassed that I never asked for it. Other students made it seem like, you know, getting help was for people who were slow. And when I struggled in class, I just kept it to myself. And as a result, I failed. I wasn't going to make the same mistake the second time around. In fact, I needed more help this time because I was living off campus and working full time. So resources were not as readily available. And like Mike relied on Phil Jackson, I too heavily relied on my academic advisor and other faculty members to help me devise a game plan to overcome my past defeats. They kept me informed about meetings, study tables, scholarships, and special events that were offered for my major. Number two, set up the triangle offense. I saw how effective the peer-to-peer learning experience was for my time with my GED students. And as a result, the first week of class, I intentionally identified two other students in the class that I could ask for help. And like Mike, I wasn't interested in putting it all on my own shoulders anymore. I needed some help. It just so happened that my boy Frank Dent and T. Black, we all had classes together. Frank was a beast when it came to test taking. He could break down the lesson in story form and give it an acronym like nobody's business. T. Black, well, T was a beast at organizing and scheduling study times. Between the two of them, I went from getting a 1.3 GPA the semester I was dismissed to a 3.5 GPA both fall and spring semester. And besides the grades, I was way more motivated to study when we did it in the group. I guess I felt more compelled to do well because, well, at the end of the week, we were comparing each other's test scores. And I didn't want to be the one. I didn't want to be the one with the C+ when they had A's. And like Mike, I now had great teammates, and I wasn't afraid to use their assistance. Number three, add weapons to your game. When MJ entered the league, he was known for his high-flying dunks that electrified the crowd. And while fun and exciting to watch, that style, it didn't lead to any championships. It wasn't until he added some less exciting but equally lethal weapons to his game that he began to win. And not just win, but win big. For instance, he developed the post game, the three-point shot, and the turnaround jumper. These were all things that allowed him to become a champion and one of the greatest players that ever played the game. In the end, the dunks and the circus moves just turned out to be icing on the cake. And like MJ, I too wanted greatness. So it was time for me to add some new, less exciting, but equally effective weapons. Number one, utilizing resources. Taking advantage of the campus resources was one of the ways I made adjustments to my academic game. For instance, I sought out a mentor. Kenny Anderson was among many of them. He schooled me on the whole college culture. He said it was like anything else. You have to learn the game so you can successfully compete. That advice, yep, that one piece of advice helped me to get a full scholarship that year. I shared with several of the faculty members, my work in the community, as well as my short and long-term plan with my degree. And before I knew it, Dr. Frazier said he would do all in his power to help me to get my degree. Lois also shared with me the importance of knowing your professors, which was highly possible at a small school. Some of the professors attended the same church, shopped at the same stores, and were advisors to many of the student-driven organizations, so there were plenty of opportunities to connect with them. In addition to those opportunities, There were the traditional office hours in which you could meet with the teacher outside of the regular scheduled class time. I found office hours to be extremely helpful, especially in the classes I struggled. Number two, maintaining a balance. Maintaining a balance was another secret Lois taught me. I always wondered how she maintained such a high GPA and graduated magna cum laude. When I paid closer attention, I picked up on her secret. Whenever there was a function, she would devote the first few minutes to her studies. Instead of waiting for the fashionably late people to show up, she studied in the meantime. And when everything was wrapping up, she didn't just go sit there. She cracked open a book. It was like she was always waiting for an opportunity to study. And between academics, work, family, and social commitments, it was important for me to find a way to balance all those competing demands. Creating a schedule was my key to success. I hated writing things down. It was frustrating trying to keep up with a pen and a planner, but it worked. There is nothing magical about a planner. It works because it helps you organize all your tasks and it keeps you accountable. Number three, establishing a routine time to study for each class. One of the things I learned from teaching the GED program was the importance of consistency. My students, like literally, they did much better when they stuck to a routine. And I feel like, you know, you got to practice what you preach. So it was important that I incorporated that same principle into my study habits. Homework was another point I drove home. I taught my students that class, that was just for warm-ups. They would not dare play in a big basketball game or a football game without warming up or practicing before the game. The same was true with learning. What I taught in the classroom was the appetizer, not the entree. And if they really wanted to pass the GED test, the real work did not begin until they studied away from the classroom. I told them that for every hour they spent in class, they needed to study 2 hours outside of class. And I incorporated that strategy into my own game plan as well. Listen to me. I made sure my routine consisted of studying for each subject at the same time and when possible, at the same place. My study routine also included more than just doing the assignment. I reviewed my notes from class, and I even studied the syllabus daily to see where I was and how far I had to go. And if I had spare time, once I went through my entire routine, I would prepare for all my classes as if, you know, there was going to be a pop quiz the next day. And as a former procrastinator, I always had to remind myself not to put off what I could do today. Number four, discovering my learning style. By discovering my learning style, I was able to study effectively rather than just, you know, winging it. And after taking a learning style test, I found out that my learning style was the following: verbal, linguistic intelligence. This person has the ability to use words and language. These learners have highly developed auditory skills and are generally elegant speakers. They think in words rather than pictures. Their skills include listening, speaking, writing, storytelling, explaining, teaching, using humor, understanding the syntax and meaning of words, remembering information, convincing someone of their point of view, analyzing language usage. Possible career interests: poet, journalist, writer, teacher, lawyer, politician, and translator. Look, and I'm serious, I need you to do yourself a huge favor. Take the time to research the learning style that works best for you. Trust me, it will make a world of difference. Number five, take care of your body. Most students, they had the slightest idea of how connected their diet is to their academic success. Man, and I had to learn this. I had to learn this the hard way. I remember studying on 4 hours of sleep and on an empty stomach or junk food. And I learned that was a surefire way to keep me struggling academically. I realized getting 6 to 8 hours of sleep, drinking 8 glasses of water a day, and exercising helped me immensely when it came to study time. I had more energy, I could study longer hours in one setting, and I retained way more information. And during test weeks, I avoided fast foods. I tried to eat more fruits and vegetables. I stopped drinking soda altogether because it had too much sugar and caffeine. Summary points for academic success. Get support. Set up the triangle offense. Add weapons to your game. Utilize your resources. Maintain a balance. Establish a routine time to study for each class. Discover your learning style and take care of your body.
Chapter 19. Don't cry over spilled milk. Wipe it up and pour yourself another glass.
My return to college in the fall of 1995 proved to be my best academic year ever. I made the dean's list for the first time in my college career, and I did it without the help of any remedial courses. And to top it off, I raised my cumulative GPA. Things were going great, to say the least. And based on my conversation with my academic advisor, the kid was projected to graduate with my degree in education May 1997. I could taste it, and I wanted it. I wanted it as bad as I wanted to breathe. But, man, in the midst of all that success, I kept telling myself, man, it's just too good to be true. Too good to be true. I wasn't trying to jinx myself or anything. I just had a hard time believing that I was finally going to make it over this academic hump. I felt like the Evans family, you know, on the TV show Good Times. Whenever it looked like they were going to get their big break and they were finally on their way to getting out of the ghetto, something bad always happened. I must have been like a distant relative of the Evans family because it seemed as though I couldn't catch a break. And when I finally did, something would always derail it. Case in point, when I found out I was being reinstated into college, I knew I couldn't afford the tuition. So I prayed and I asked God to bless me, and he came through in a major way. I'm really not sure how it all happened. I just remember one minute I was meeting with my financial aid counselor, and the next, well, somebody sent me to Trevor Frazier, and he gave me a full scholarship. At that time, I only had a 1.7 GPA. Talk about a miracle. Later, I heard through the grapevine that he was leaving the university at the end of the school year to pursue his own PhD. Man, that could only mean one thing. No Frazier, no scholarship. And I thought to myself, here we go again. This made me question whether I wasted an entire year sitting in class instead of developing myself as a speaker. What about graduation? What about my career? How was I supposed to take care of my family? I mean, I loved the community work I was doing, but it didn't generate income. And although the speaking engagements were picking up like crazy, it wasn't steady income either. It was a blessing that Dee Dee had started her career, but we were so swamped with old bills, the money was spent, before she even got her check. I felt like someone knocked the wind out of me. Once again, I was at a point in my life where I needed to make a decision. Was I going to let the bad news get the best of me and destroy the momentum I built, or was I going to take the limits that life was throwing at me and make lemonade? I would be lying if I said it didn't hurt, because it did. And so I just acknowledged the hurt, went through the whole gamut, the whole gamut of emotions, and then I moved on. A setback is a setup for a comeback. After the disappointment of my scholarship not being continued, I got a major breakthrough from my mentor, Kenny Anderson. I'll never forget the day he called and asked if I could present the work I was doing with high school dropouts at the Southeast Center for Human Relations National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in the American Higher Education, NCORE, in Atlanta. The invitation was huge because NCORE didn't invite me. In fact, they didn't even know about my program. They didn't even know I existed. Kenny was the one that invited me, and he was willing to give me 10 minutes of his time. He invited me because he wanted those in attendance to see that there were young black men doing positive things in their community, and that the media should spend more time not just highlighting the stories of negativity, but highlighting the success stories. I thought the best way to utilize the opportunity was to let either two or three of my GED students speak directly to how the program had impacted their lives. One of the girls was a teenage mom who had recently received her GED, got a job, and was in college. Another was a young man who was recently in and out of jail and in gangs and had now turned his life around. After I spoke, the place went bananas, and my public speaking career took off. At least three high-profile engagements came out of that one invitation and created the momentum that I'm still riding to this day. The first invitation was from Dr. Eric Abercrombie, who invited me to speak at the University of Cincinnati's Black Man Think Tank. The second invitation was from the director of Diversity Magazine. He invited me to be a guest speaker on their annual teleconference. The third invitation came from Miss Juanita Smith. She invited me to speak at Florida A&M's Black Student Retention Conference. After that, the call started pouring in. There were two engagements specifically that meant the world to me. The first was an invitation by Dr. Joseph McMillan, the founder of the Black Family Conference at the University of Louisville. Dr. Mack invited me back every year, and he and the Black Family Conference staff adopted me as one of their own. The second invitation would change my life forever. It was from Rodney Patterson and Murray Edwards from Michigan State University. I broke into the speaking circuit and was finally able to make a living doing what I love, but I knew I wouldn't be satisfied. This wasn't the entire vision, just a part of it. The University of Cincinnati. Dr. Eric Abercrombie founded the Black Man Think Tank. I still get goosebumps just thinking about my first standing ovation before a huge crowd. There were about 1,800 professionals in attendance. When I walked on stage, all I could see was the stage light shining in my face. I kept thinking to myself, E, just relax. Just like we rehearsed this thing, all you have to do is remember how we rehearsed it, and it will be just fine. I specifically requested a lapel microphone so I could be free. You know, free to move around and use my body as a prop. It was the fastest 8 minutes of my life. As soon as I finished my last words, everybody in the room started clapping and one by one stood to their feet. As I exited the stage, I passed by a mirror. I stopped. I looked at myself in the mirror and I thought, I'm proud of you. Yeah, I'm proud of you. They gave you a shot and you nailed it. During the intermission, I went into the lobby for a meet and greet, and I must have passed out a ton of business cards and received about 10 other speaking engagements. But none were more meaningful than that one offer I got to speak at Michigan State University. The thought of leaving Detroit as a homeless high school dropout and returning home to lecture at one of Michigan's finest institutions was overwhelming. The University of Louisville and Michigan State University. I was able to distinguish very early in my speaking career that different institutions had different intentions for inviting me to their campus. Some institutions invited me to their campus to motivate their students. Nothing more, nothing less. Then there were institutions like U of L and MSU that had a much broader vision. The late Dr. Joseph McMillan of the University of Louisville founded the Black Family Conference, which began in 1978. Rodney Patterson and Murray Edwards founded the Black Male Conference at Michigan State University. Both conferences drew educational professionals, parents, community leaders, and researchers from all over the country to discuss issues affecting African-American families and communities. I presented every year until both conferences were eventually discontinued because of funding issues. I was disappointed that the conferences had come to an end. However, because of the strong relationship I built at Michigan State University with Rodney and Murray, they offered me the opportunity to finish my four-year degree at Michigan State University or to attend graduate school there if and when I finish my undergrad somewhere else.
Chapter 20, Miracle Territory. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Hebrews 11:1.
I was driving through campus one day, you know, doing my lunch break. And all of a sudden, I noticed the president of the university, Delbert Baker. He was just standing on the curb by the physical plant building. So I pulled over and asked him, "Is everything okay?" He said that his car was in the shop and that he needed a ride to the mechanic. I'm thinking to myself, what are the chances that the president of the university is standing on the corner needing a ride just as I was driving by? I knew, I knew God had placed me in miracle territory again. Not long in the car, he told me that his wife had been telling him about me. You know, about the impact I had on their youngest son, Jonathan. Now, Jonathan was deep into the Bible, but he struggled with the content of certain textbooks. So I decided to use some of the religious materials he enjoyed to teach him the lessons as opposed to asking him to learn in a traditional way. Not only was his interest in school rekindled, our relationship grew. And as we drove on, President Baker asked me why I hadn't finished my degree. And my response was simple, because of financial struggles. And less than a few minutes later, crazy, he picked up the phone, made a phone call, and I had a full, I'm talking about all expenses paid scholarship to finish the rest of my degree. He hooked me up with a work-study position in the Office of Recruitment. My job was easy. I traveled across the world of high schools and recruited students to Oakwood University. I was truly in miracle territory, and this time, I had no plans of leaving or messing it up. See, the thing I love about miracle territory is that it's so random. It usually happens when you least expect it. Look, one day I was in church enjoying service when Miss Presley walked up beside me and asked, "Eric, can I talk to you after church?" "Sure." "See, the school is interested in having you speak to the student body sometimes next week." At that time, I didn't have any other commitments, so I told her I'd love to do it. The session went very well, and the following week, I met with the principal, Miss Friesen, and she asked me about taking a position as a substitute teacher. She explained to me that the English teacher had broken her ankle and they needed a replacement until she returned. I was originally told the teacher would be out for about 5 to 6 weeks, but 2 months had passed by and she still hadn't returned. Miss Friesen eventually hired a new English teacher at the end of the year and offered me a full-time position as a speech and drama teacher for the remainder of the year and the following year. I gladly accept it. Oakwood Academy. I am a firm believer that good things do happen to good people. It's just a matter of timing. Those 4 years in the projects, helping high school dropouts get their GED, it paid off. And it paid off in a major way. It gave me over 5 years of experience in the classroom. And even though I didn't have my college degree at the time, I was still hired by Ms. Friesen because of that experience. She told me when she reviewed my resume that she based her decision on several factors. One factor was the impact I had on students. In less than half a year, I was able to help a number of failing and borderline students regain the confidence they needed in their academic abilities, as well as I helped them to get excited about learning. Another was the fact that I was back in school and I only needed a few semesters to complete my degree. And after all those years of working primarily for free, I could finally tell Dee Dee that I had my first real job with benefits. Those few years at the academy were huge. For one, Ms. Friesen's decision to hire me elevated my confidence in a major way. Oakwood was a small community, so it was no secret that some of the most influential members of the school board disapproved of her decision to hire me. That made me work that much harder for her. She pushed me professionally and personally, but she never tried to box me in. Instead, she created a structure, that's right, that harnessed my creativity and supported my unconventional teaching style. I will always be indebted to her for believing in me and giving me a chance when others were not willing to do so. The love and support I received from my students also helped shape me as an educator. They trusted me enough to embrace my untraditional instructional style and respected me to the point that they made every attempt possible to reach the standard I set for them. We cried together, we traveled together, we laughed together, and more importantly, we grew and we matured together. It would be impossible to share my entire teaching experience in this book, but these are some specific reasons I'm able to experience a high level of success when working with students. Tip number one, build a relationship. After struggling early with some of my more challenging students in the class, I sought advice from a mentor who had been working with troubled youth for a number of years. The advice was simple, yet game-changing. Students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. It's not uncommon for these students to be abandoned by one or more parents, and that often leads to mistrust of adults. I decided to take a personal interest in my students' life, not just in the classroom, but outside of the classroom. I stayed after school a day or two a week, and I got to know them on a personal level. Sometimes we play a little basketball, or I'd simply ask them a question about life. You know, how things were going at home. How are your siblings doing? How did your basketball game go the other day? I mean, simple questions like that, that allowed the students to see that I cared about them, not only academically, but personally as well. I saw how demonstrating that type of interest went a long way, not only in building a good relationship with the students, but its effect on their academics as well. Tip two, remember, each student is different. While it's important as an educator to use my past experiences to deal with future situations, I had to remember that no two students are the same. Early in my career, I was guilty, you know, guilty of placing certain expectations on a student because I recognized like similar behavior patterns from the previous student that I struggled to reach. For example, if I had two students with anger issues that failed to thrive in my class the previous year, the next year I automatically assumed that there was no possible way to reach the student who demonstrated similar personality characteristics. By making that assumption though, man, I failed to make a legitimate attempt at maximizing the student's learning potential. Instead of choosing to focus on a student who had a chance to succeed, my thought processes were quickly redirected through a number of success stories, including my own. And from that day forward, I treated each and every student as a unique individual. Tip three, find a balance. So like many new teachers, I made a critical error. That error was trying to be the cool teacher. Being young and naive, I figured I would waltz in the classroom with my hip hop approach and the students would automatically respond to me, you know, because of my swag. Although back then, it wasn't swag. It was fresh. While it's true that students love being in my class, it wasn't because of my depth of knowledge or intellectual creativity. It was because I was a pushover. I mean, seriously, by refusing to discipline students in fear that they might not think I was a cool teacher, the students ran circles around me. However, I observed teachers with the exact opposite style. They were constantly yelling and screaming at students, writing referrals, and sending students to the office. And they too failed to positively impact their students academically. But by the second semester, I discovered a balance that is still effective to this day. I set a tone in the class. I was the teacher and they were the students. I made the rules and they followed the rules. I set high expectations and they did their best to reach them. I acknowledged their accomplishments and affirmed them every opportunity I had. There were some casual moments in the classroom, but best believe I made sure there were some tough and focused moments as well. Tip 4, create an energetic learning environment. One of the most difficult tasks when dealing with grade school students, is figuring out a way to harness that massive amount of energy that accompanies them. I found myself dreaming of a classroom where I'd be able to execute my lesson plan without interruption. You know, where kids sat down the entire day, remained on task, and didn't have to use the bathroom every 30 seconds. I quickly realized that these thoughts were just a fantasy and soon discovered a way to use their energy to my advantage. By creating an energetic learning environment where students were encouraged to use their energy for problem solving and learning, my students' performance quickly accelerated. Using a balance of collaborative learning and individual learning methods with icebreakers, quiz bowls, and Jeopardy games, all while keeping the energy high-paced and fun, my students began to gravitate toward learning and quickly went from "do we have to" attitude to "can we please" attitude. I also incorporated a heavy cultural relevant pedagogy to make their learning experience more engaging. In short, a culturally relevant pedagogy uses the cultural knowledge, prior experiences, frames of reference, and performance styles of ethnically diverse students to make learning more relevant and effective for students. It teaches through and to the strengths of these students. It is culturally validating and affirming. Therefore, create the environment that challenges and allows your students to be creative and critical in their thinking. Trust me, you'll thank me for it later. Tip 5, involve the parents as much as possible. One of the most difficult challenges I faced while working in a low-income school was trying to get parents involved in their students' academic life. As I stated earlier, many of my students come from single-parent homes, usually moms. And the parent often doesn't have time to check in on his or her child during the school hours. And one of the ways I was able to combat this issue was by making positive phone calls to their home. I realized that the only time I ever made a call home was when a child was failing or had poor classroom behavior. It never dawned on me that positive calls could have a positive impact on student improvement. Not once in my first year of teaching did I call home to tell a parent that their child did an excellent job in the class and that I wanted them to acknowledge the child the first chance they had. As it turns out, parents are much more likely to have a conversation with you when their child is doing well than when their child is doing poorly. You'd be surprised. By taking small steps, like making positive calls home, I was able to build a rapport with the parents. And as a result, when it's time to make that "your child is struggling" call, they were much more willing to listen and take action. Tip 6, be a lifelong learner. I had to come to the conclusion that professional development was the missing link and the key to making me a successful teacher. And once the school year ended, whew, I read every book I can get my hands on about best practices for good teachers. The Marva Collins Way was the first book I researched. Her work highlighted the practical yet innovative strategies teachers can use to bring the best out of all their students, despite their academic background. And when I wasn't reading, I was watching every film about success in the classroom. I had an unusual ability to watch films like most people use workshops or other professional development sessions, and I applied them to my practice. The two films that resonate most with me were Lean on Me and Stand and Deliver. Both films demonstrated how educators could serve as real change agents by using aggressive, proactive, and innovative strategies for school improvement. In addition to what I learned from outside research, I also learned a great deal from my own students as well. I quickly learned that students have a wealth of knowledge about what works and what doesn't work in the classroom. Eventually, I decided to pull a few interested students to the side and involve them in the creative process of designing the lesson plan and other related issues. Tip 7, give students a sense of purpose. One of the things that concerned me most was the lack of interest a number of my students had in the learning process as a whole. I always believed that there was a direct connection between student performance and student interest. A number of my students who had academic challenges were more than capable of excelling. The problem was they didn't see the benefit of school, and I made it my business to help students make that connection. For instance, I brought in guest presenters from different professional backgrounds to share their story. Also, Mason West and I, we created a theatrical group called Acting Up that traveled with me during my college tours. And on the academic side, I started a reading initiative for upperclassmen called the Billion Dollar Book Club, which encouraged students and rewarded them for reading. These small initiatives ignited the school spirit and created a bond between the school staff and the students. And once the students made the connection to how school could have a positive impact on their lives, the whole approach to learning changed for the better. Summary: effective means of working with students. Tips 1-7. Build a relationship. Remember, each student is different. Find a balance. Create an energetic learning environment. Involve the parents as much as possible. Be a lifelong learner. And finally, give students a sense of purpose.
Chapter 21, Homecoming. Do you think about me now and then? Do you think about me now and then? 'Cause I'm coming home again. Do you think about me now and then? Do you think about me now and then? Oh, 'cause I'm coming home again. Maybe we can start again. Kanye West.
By 1998, I had everything a man could ask for. My marriage was going great, my career was on the rise, and I had a great position on campus. And not to mention, I was back in school with a degree on the horizon. I also had my second child, my baby girl, Jada. Life was great, but I must be honest, school was challenging. Man, I remember school being so frustrating that I had to put my books down and do what I called back then, you can do it visualization. I pretended that I was at my graduation. I mean, the exercise was simple. Why? Because I had gone to every single graduation since I arrived on campus. One of the reasons I went back every single year was due to the fact that I felt, even though I didn't graduate, I needed to support my friends. One of the other reasons I went to the graduation was because, man, it burned. I mean, it hurt. It hurt not only to see my friends graduating, but it hurt to see my peers, siblings, and younger cousins graduate before me. I enrolled at Oakwood in 1989, and here it was, 1998. Each time I attended a graduation, it cut me like a knife. But that's exactly what I needed it to do. I learned that pain produces certain things that complacency can't. So when I was tired of studying, I would put my books down, walk through the living room, pretending I had on my cap and gown. Then I heard the announcer say,
"Graduating with a bachelor's of science from the College of Business, Mr. Eric Thomas."
Man, I was so motivated after doing that exercise that I would run back to my study area and put in another 2 hours in the schoolwork. I finally completed my degree after 12 long years. Wow. As I put on my cap and my gown and I looked in the mirror, I began to cry. Tears, tears of joy. I thought about all the cold nights sleeping in abandoned buildings in Detroit. I thought about the moment I found out who my biological father was. I thought about my wife and my kids and how proud I was to be a father and a husband. And I thought about Bob and all those people who had poured into me when I was at my lowest point in life. That moment, a calmness, a peace came over me. It was a peace that I had never experienced before. It was a feeling of ultimate peace. I was no longer being held back by my thoughts of academic inadequacy. I was no longer mad at my mother or my biological father. I was no longer mad at myself for the foolish decisions I had made in the past. At that moment, I realized that God had a true plan for my life all along. And I understood that He birthed me to be a champion for the underdog. And to be that champion, He put me through the fire. So when I spoke to people who are at their lowest point in life with seemingly no way out, I could honestly tell them that it's possible to rise up and succeed no matter what. And months later, I began thinking about the opportunity Rodney and Murray gave me at Michigan State University in regards to graduate school. It was consuming my thoughts, man. I kept thinking to myself, even though I had never finished high school and barely managed to finish my bachelor's degree, wouldn't it be crazy? Like, wouldn't it be crazy to give graduate school a shot? But that would mean leaving everything Dee Dee and I had worked for behind for a graduate assistantship that really didn't even pay much. That would mean leaving our home, Dee Dee's job, my influence in the city, and all of my family and friends behind. The question was I willing to make that kind of sacrifice? Hesitant, because I knew it was going to sound crazy. I finally talked to Dee Dee about it. She laughed at first because she thought I was joking. And once she realized I was serious, the discussion heated up. Dee was trying to convince me that we had everything we've ever dreamed of. We had the house, the family, the secure jobs, and a community of friends who loved and supported us. But I explained to her as best as I could that I was positive that this was the calling of God. To which she replied, "Well, why don't you go up there to school? Get settled in, and the kids and I, we'll come up when you get everything in order." "No, Dee Dee. No," I said, "there's absolutely no way I can do this without you and the kids. Y'all are my life, and I need you by my side if I'm going to make this work." Reluctantly, Dee Dee agreed to leave everything we had worked for behind in order to pursue a new opportunity in Michigan, the place where it all began. The next morning, I went online and I downloaded an application for the College of Education master's degree in K-12 Educational Administration with an emphasis in leadership. Finally, I received a large green and white package with the Michigan State University insignia. My heart began to race, just as it did with the GED letter and the Oakwood College letter. I opened it and it read, "Dear Mr. Thomas, your application for admission to the master's degree program in K-12 Educational Administration has been reviewed. I am pleased to inform you that you have been recommended for admission." Epilogue. Believe it or not, I finished my master's degree in 2 short years. And as I write this, I am a semester away from completing my PhD coursework at Michigan State University. Imagine that. Dr. Eric D. Thomas. Sort of has a ring to it, doesn't it? Listen, we all face challenges in this world, and life is certainly not always easy. But as the expression goes, it's not about the hand you're dealt, but how you play your cards. Looking back, there is no way I could have imagined my life being so fulfilled. I'm still happily married to my high school sweetheart, and my kids are growing ever so fast. And I love, absolutely love what I do for a living. But if I could have you take just one thing away from this book, it would be that there is absolutely no magical formula for success. It's about having a dream and being willing to work toward it, no matter what the circumstances, negative or positive. In basketball, there's a saying that goes, "The only way to get out of a shooting slump is to keep on shooting." The same can be said about life. The only way to get out of mediocrity is to keep shooting for excellence. Always, and I mean, always remember that success is not a destination. It's a journey. To this day, that's right, to this day, E.T. the hip hop preacher still hears more no's than yes. The difference between me then and the ET now is the fact that no's don't frustrate me anymore. Now, the no's actually serve as a motivation for the next endeavor. We all have the ability to produce greatness in our lives. Not one single person on this earth is exactly like you. This means not one person on this earth can do exactly what you were born to do. The question is, what were you born to do? Now that's a question that only you can answer. It's your boy, E.T.
This has been an ETA Incorporated production of The Secret to Success, written by Eric Thomas, narrated by Eric Thomas and Charles Arrington. Copyright by ETA 2013, Grand Ledge, Michigan, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2012 by ETA Associates Incorporated. Recording engineer, Jamie Cook. Mixing engineer and sound engineer, Benjamin Rickert. Produced by Dilsey Mosley, Eric Thomas, Carlos Quinney Jr., Carl Phillips, Jamie Cook, and Benjamin Rickert. For more information on the web, etinspires.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.